Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Today on Route 51, the subject is wolves and cougars and bobcats and bears and elk and white-tailed deer, the large mammals that make Wisconsin's woods and prairies one of the great natural habitats in the world. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on a Route 51 show that's been rescheduled from last month when we had some technical problems, we welcome again two experts on the UW Stevens Point faculty, Dr. Eric Anderson, a professor of wildlife ecology who has researched our state's large carnivore population, cougars, bobcats, and wolves, and Dr. Scott Hinkstrom, the Douglas R. Stevens Chair in Wildlife and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Wildlife. He's an expert on white-tailed deer and the reintroduction of elk into our state. Whenever we do shows on this topic, we get a lot of phone calls, and there is a lot to talk about. The decision to revitalize Wisconsin's elk herd by bringing in animals from Kentucky. The decision to reclassify wolves as an endangered species, which has put an end to Wisconsin's wolf hunt after only two seasons. And what about the impact of proposed changes to the DNR, eliminating the positions of 18 scientists and making the Natural Resources Board only an advisory body? Now, if you'd like to contribute to the conversation, our phone number is 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Again, that's 1-800-780-9742. Eric Anderson, Scott Hinkstrom, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to hit the political stuff right away and kind of get that out of the way and then start talking about our large animal population. Eric, UW Stevens Point may be hit hard by the governor's proposed $300 million in budget cuts. Is that going to impact your work and the work of your fellow scientists and instructors at the College of Natural Resources?
Absolutely. The amount of faculty that we have relative to students is, it's a pretty big disparity between how many students we have and how much faculty we have trying to deal with it. So these budget cuts are going to hurt from that standpoint, but they're also going to hurt from another standpoint, which is we do a lot of research, and to do that research, we require funding. A lot of that funding comes from the state, and those science budget dollars are being cut as well.
Scott Hinkstrom, I'll let you weigh in on this, too.
Sure. I was in our budget meetings, and we're having to deal with about a little over a million dollar cut in the College of Natural Resources, and so it cuts deep. And the college has had to deal with budget cuts in the past, and so upon the words of our dean, we've been whittled to the bone already. So now we're having to cut into personnel positions and programs, and that obviously is going to affect what our relationship is and what we can do with our students.
And again, these cuts haven't been finalized yet. The final budget hasn't been drawn up, and folks who are concerned about those kinds of things know that they can contact their state lawmakers and tell them either to cut the cuts or not do them at all.
That's right.
Let's move on to some items of statewide interest that have natural resources implications. We have a Wisconsin State Board comprised of elected officials, and they voted 2-1 on Tuesday to ban staff members from doing any work related to climate change on state time. This is the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. They've already removed a reference to climate change from their website after complaints by one of three board members, State Treasurer Matt Adamczyk. He's a Republican who recently sought to dismiss Board Executive Director Tia Nelson from her post after learning that she served on former Governor Jim Doyle's Global Warming Task Force back in 2007 and 2008. If the name sounds familiar, it's because Nelson is the daughter of former Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, who's the founder of Earth Day. Adamczyk said he's bothered by Nelson's service on the task force. He says it's got nothing to do with the board's business. But another board member, Democrat Doug LaFollette, said the agency should have at least some concern about climate change, because foresters are worried about how that is affecting the growth of timber and the board owns about 77,000 acres of land, including timber acreage it manages for income that can be used for public projects. So, what's your reaction to that? Do you think state officials who are overseeing public projects or public land should be told not to talk about climate change?
Well, I certainly would say that we all need to talk about climate change. Climate change is something that's been well documented as occurring, and as a society, we need to be aware of and concerned about climate change. There are questions as to whether humans have accelerated the climate change or whether it's naturally occurring. I think there's the good evidence that indicates that humans have accelerated the occurrence of climate change. Here, where we are, it's a little difficult to see it because we have relatively complex, a complex environment. But if you travel to the poles or go to Alaska, I've been there three times. It's very evident as far as climate change and the recession of glaciers and the fires on the tundra. Things are very obvious there where they're not so obvious here, but we need to talk about it.
Well, we have serious drought problems in California, too, and water rationing.
Well, climate change leads to drought. It leads to excessive rain. It leads to violent weather. And so it's hard to just say that it leads to drought. But overall, there's going to be an increase in temperature, we anticipate, which in time will lead to drought.
Have any state officials put pressure on you or anyone else working at the College of Natural Resources to tell you folks to stop talking about climate change? Is that something that's happened yet?
No, not at UW-Stevens Point, that's for sure. One other comment I'd like to make about the climate change issue thing here is if we choose not to face it and ignore it, it becomes more and more difficult for us to be able to deal with it in the future. So rather than pretending it's not happening, much better to try to think forward about how we are going to deal with the changes. And we're quite aware that there are changes going on, well-documented changes in the state.
Now, Governor Walker has also proposed changing the Natural Resources Board from a policy-making body to a purely advisory body. Is DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp told lawmakers that she agrees with the change, although she says the governor didn't consult with her before proposing it. What would that do to wildlife management in the state if the Natural Resources Board became an advisory board instead of a rulemaking board?
Right now, the benefit of having the Natural Resource Advisory Board is that there's a conduit for the public to get their voice heard within the management of the wildlife of the state. Without that, through the Conservation Congress, through the Natural Resource Board, there's really no way for the public to have an input. It's done behind closed doors. It's politically open to a lot of closed-door kind of changes. So I think in the long run, we're losing the people's voice when we do that.
Senator Tom Tiffany, who's a Republican of Hazelhurst, is in favor of the change. He says the Natural Resources Board is not elected. It is therefore unaccountable to the voters, transferring more power, he says, to the Secretary of the DNR, and having the Conservation Congress report directly to her would make the department more accountable and efficient. Your reaction?
Well, I would say that this morning I listened on public radio and I heard my dean, Christine Thomas, speak to this matter.
And she's a member of the Natural Resources Board.
She's a longtime member of the Natural Resources Board, formerly a chair, but she spoke for the Natural Resources Board and made the perspective that with the board in its current state, the public does have direct impact on policy decision making, whereas the potential would lead to, if it goes to strictly the powers of the secretary, these decisions could be made with little public input. They could be backdoor or behind-the-door decisions. And so I stand with our dean as far as her perspective on public input.
And some background information. The Natural Resources Board, as an independent body in this state, goes back to the 1920s. And up until 1995, it actually had the power to fire the DNR secretary. Another part of the budget would terminate 66 positions in the Department of Natural Resources, including 18 scientists in the Bureau of Science Services. That proposal was criticized by former DNR Secretary George Meyer of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. It is also supported by Senator Tom Tiffany. We're going to listen to both of them. First of all, here's George Meyer on the public television show Here and Now with Frederica Freiberg.
These are fundamental positions within the agency. They do all the basic research, for instance, on fish and wildlife and the habitat, which are the foundations for most of the hunting, fishing, trapping, land management recommendations that are undertaken by the agency. We need this information.
When you saw the budget and saw those cuts, what was your first thought?
I couldn't believe it, that the that such an important part of natural resources management, which we've had within the department for over 100 years, was being taken away.
What do you think the motivation is?
Well, from what I've read, there are some concerns about some of the results of some of the research that's been done, whether it was bobcat research or climate change impacts or mine impacts. My answer to that is it's important to have that information. Policymakers still have to make the policy, and they may go against the science, but at least know what is being, what the impacts might be.
That's George Meyer, former DNR secretary and also the chair of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. Let's listen now to Republican Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst on the same program.
You know, if you talk to my constituents here in northern Wisconsin, there's probably not one in a thousand that know what the Bureau of Science Services does and does it bring value to the taxpayers. Quick example, they help set the deer herd numbers. And in northern Wisconsin, deer hunt has been a disaster the last few years. We were urging a number of years ago for them to reduce the antlerless permits that were being issued, and they did not do so until this past year. And, you know, we could go into bobcats and other other predators that they help manage, and I don't think they've done a good job of it here, especially for those of us in northern Wisconsin.
Now, I do know that, that Bureau, the scientists, kind of wrote an exhaustive report and analysis on the Gogebic mine. Did that factor into you believing that they really don't serve the taxpayers well?
Yeah, not really. I never did read the report that they put out, but it is interesting that they partnered with Northland College and one of their professors up there, who's one of the most anti-mining zealots that you'll find in the state of Wisconsin, that they would use a person like that to do their so-called science. I think it does call into question some of the work that they do.
Senator Tom Tiffany, who did not like that study on the proposed Gogebic taconite mine, and he says the DNR science is suspect. He favors the termination of those 18 positions. Your reaction, Eric Anderson?
Oh, it's simply that knowledge forms the basis for making informed decisions. As George Meyer said, you aren't making policy. You're just informing policy by doing the science. And to cut the science out because you're not happy with how management was done doesn't mean the scientists are at fault. It just means that perhaps the management approach was inappropriate. But science is important.
We also learned this week that Governor Walker's administration considered making Bob Seitz, who was the lobbyist for Gogebic Taconite, that company that wanted to build the Pinocchio Hills mine. They wanted to make Mr. Seitz the deputy secretary of the DNR. But because of his work for the mining company lobbying the state, his appointment would have run afoul of federal law, so they found a different job for Mr. Seitz. Should lobbyists for mining companies be put in charge of the environmental agency that is supposed to oversee the operation of the mine? That's my question, Scott Hingstrom.
Well, you know, I can sort of beg off on that question because I'm very new to Wisconsin. I only moved here in September, and so I don't have the full background of the experiences and knowledge and science that's there. I would say that we should be making public decisions based on sound science, on public input, on industry, on economics. We look for a wide range of inputs before we make decisions.
Should the people running the DNR have a science background?
Well, I think DNR, the upper-level administrators, they need to be good administrators. And by being good administrators, they have to have skills in information collecting, in weeding through a lot of different sources of information, but then working with their staff. And that staff should include scientists to be able to make well-informed decisions.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Ray, you're on Route 51 with Eric Anderson and Scott Hingstrom.
Well, thank you all for being on and addressing these issues. My main concern and many others, I live in northern Wisconsin. We have seen the scientists scientific research in the process. We've interacted with these different scientists, the DNR, sportsmen, etc. We see the ongoing research as valid. I'm very concerned, and others are, that what is going to happen to the resource in the long run then? How is this present administration going to replace this? And what decisions are going to be made for the future of this state, its resources, the animals, the public input, and also about climate change? When you're out in the field, even as a person as I, you see the climate change, the effects on the resources. It's cross-referencing. You know, it's like I feel, and others, that this is all stuff to slip in, so private interest, whether it be corporate or self-interest, without any public input, any scientific fact, can just slip in whatever they want to slip in, and then here we go, status quo, where we're going back to the Stone Age 30, 40 years ago when we were trying to get all this done. So the summation here is there's scientific fact for all this. It's bona fide. We have the finest researchers in the world, and we're concerned. So I'll take the comment off the air, and once again, thank you for addressing this.
Thank you, Ray, for your comment. Which of you gentlemen would like to handle that?
All I will add is, Ray, knowledge is power, and we can't make good decisions without having that good science backing. And you can't ignore facts. Climate change is a fact. This state is warming. We know that. And so to try to ignore it and think it will go away because you don't acknowledge it isn't a very prudent way to approach the future. So I'm optimistic. I think that ultimately these are people of reason and will understand the value of the information that are provided by scientists. So I can be hopeful that way.
Let's move on to another area. Changes in the stewardship program in the governor's budget. It would freeze land purchases for 13 years until 2028 when the debt stewardship program, or rather the state currently has, is paid off.
Well, with the stewardship program, funding comes from a variety of sources, and to just simply freeze it for an arbitrary 13-year period, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm a person who likes to have flexibility in management, and such a dictate would really impact administrators into the far into the future. And so I am concerned about what impacts there are in the short term as well as the long term on such a decision.
That could impact public land for hunting as well.
Oh, certainly, yeah. For hunting, for bird watching, for photography, for any of our natural resource uses.
There's also a proposal to stop funding state parks, maybe fund them by giving out naming rights. And the silence there is happening. let's move on to large animal wildlife. I want to talk about something that's of concern to some folks, and that's the state of our white-tailed deer herd. And I'm going to reference a column by Bill Leaders this week in which he talked about the growing problem of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's herd. In 2014, he says, 6% of the 5,400 deer tested were positive. That's an all-time high. The disease rate among adult male deer has reached 40% in north-central Iowa County, and chronic wasting disease is now no longer found only in southern Wisconsin. Here's something from the article. Tammy Ryan, who's the DNR's wildlife health section chief, says the numbers were not unexpected, given that the state is no longer attempting to manage the disease, but is instead just monitoring its distribution. Earlier attempts to employ more aggressive strategies on chronic wasting disease were abandoned because of intense public opposition. Scott Hingstrom, you're the white-tailed deer expert. Your reaction to chronic wasting disease and the statistics that Bill Leaders brought out in his column.
Well, I can speak to Tammy Ryan. I know she's right on target with her concerns. I haven't read that article, so I haven't been up to date on those stats. But I can say, and I've worked on CWD for the last 15 years, chronic wasting disease is a disease that is spreading wherever it has occurred, and it's increasing in prevalence wherever it has occurred. where it started out in Fort Collins, Colorado. Just not far from there, it is now exceeding 30% in its white-tailed deer and mule deer populations. In north central Wyoming, it has exceeded 55%, and now we've seen that herd reduced in number by half. And so now it is having a dramatic impact on the population. That's the first I've seen of that occurring. So here we are in Wisconsin. We have it at, you said, 6% and over 40% in the males. It's largely believed that the male percentage of the population is very active in spreading that disease. And so, therefore, I anticipate fully that chronic wasting disease will continue to spread throughout Wisconsin and increase in prevalence.
What steps should be taken to get it under control, and how do you implement those steps given past public opposition?
Well, you know, if we had a quick and easy fix, we would have administered it 15, 20 years ago. But the problem is there is no quick and easy fix. This is a disease that is pervasive in the environment where it occurs. And so the deer shed it from one deer to another. They also shed it onto the ground, and so other deer pick it up when they're in the area. We don't have a management tool right now that we can use to fix it. Looking out into the future, there are private companies that are working on a vaccine for chronic wasting disease. A challenge with that is administering it. How do we get it out to all of those deer that are in the state of Wisconsin? We've looked at population reduction, but population density isn't the only thing that affects chronic wasting disease in the population, because it's still there in the environment, so deer can pick it up.
But one suggestion was maybe we extend the gun deer season and let people shoot more bucks, but if you extended it earlier, that runs into the bow hunters, and they're a pretty powerful lobbying group in Wisconsin.
Yeah. The unfortunate truth is probably these adult males are the ones that are most active in spreading the disease, and you have groups that really would love to extend the age of adult male white-tailed deer so they look, you know, with big antlers and big racks. Well, those are the ones that are most likely shedding the disease. You know, over 50% of the male white-tailed deer that are adults are positive in some of these areas, and so they're spreading it. So if you're looking at it from a managed perspective, we should be managing it for a young-aged population with relatively few adult male deer in the population to reduce the rate of transmission of the disease. That doesn't strike well with the people who like the opportunity of being able to shoot a big Boone and Crockett buck. So, and exactly, you said too, the potential impacts between the rifle hunters, the muzzleloader hunters, the bow hunters, and the overlaps of those seasons, then you get into a whole nother dynamic, which is within the hunting community. I wish we had all worked together to fight this disease rather than fighting within the hunting community.
Well, finally, Bill Leaders asks, if the scientists are right and the Wisconsin deer hunt is devastated as a result, will the politicians get the blame?
Well, I don't know who will get the blame in the future on this matter. I think Wisconsin was very proactive in its approach to reduce densities in a big way in south central part of the state where it first broke out in Iowa County. Unfortunately, the landowners didn't appreciate the approach, and many would say it was a heavy-handed approach that the Department of Natural Resources took to implement reductions in the densities, and if they didn't, they were going to fly helicopters and shoot deer. Well, you know, they tried to make a statement at that time because, as my advisor, Scott Craven, stated, if we don't do something now, our children or our grandchildren will look upon us as being failures in the management of deer in Wisconsin.
We had a very disappointing deer hunt in 2014, the lowest kill in 32 years, the lowest license sales since 1976. This has led to some of the dissatisfaction with the DNR, which is making cuts to the agency popular. How much of this is due to mismanagement by the DNR, which its critics charge, and how much is due to weather, climate change, other factors?
Well, I think there was a lot that happened last year that was very strange. I've actually been a resident of Nebraska for the last 26 years, but I've come back and hunted with my father on our farm in western Wisconsin for all of those years. For 43 years, I've been hunting straight, and so I do feel like I've been a hunter of Wisconsin, and last year was one of the strangest years I've ever experienced. I didn't see a deer until about 10 a.m. on opening day, and it was a young buck, and I shot it myself, and usually I would have passed on it. And that was the only deer I saw for, you know, the first half of the day. And a lot of other hunters in Wisconsin experienced the same thing. But part of it was that there were a lot of crops in, so deer were still in the cornfields. It was foggy. It was misty. It was raining. It was kind of miserable, so the deer weren't moving around. And that continued on through much of the week. And so usually my father and I, we take, you know, 5 or 6 deer a year to fill the freezer. I was the only one of the two who had taken a deer by Thanksgiving Day. Then my father finally, you know, put another deer in the freezer. So, but that was kind of indicative of what many people experienced. I don't necessarily think it was because the densities of deer have declined dramatically. I think they are down, and we've seen a reduction in the deer harvest in Wisconsin over the last 3 years. So no doubt the deer densities were down. But that actually was part of the goal of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, was to reduce deer densities to a level that was more tolerable for landowners, for people who hit deer with cars, for the forest communities who are being impacted by perhaps artificially elevated deer populations.
If you just joined us, we're talking to wildlife ecologist Scott Hingstrom and Eric Anderson about our large wildlife population in the state of Wisconsin. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. When we come back, we're going to talk about wolves, and we're going to hear right now from tribal elder Joe Rose of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, 2 years ago at a hearing on the wolf hunt in Stevens Point, describing the relationship between man and wolf in the Ojibwe population.
It was both Anishinaabe and Moingan, man and wolf, that returned to get some Manado, the Great Spirit. And so man and wolf stood in the presence of Getsemanado. And so the Great Spirit spoke to both of them. In many ways, the two of you are alike. When you take a mate, it will be for life. Your social order will be very complex. And so Moingan was given the wolf pack. Anishinaabe was given the clan system. Both of you will make your living by the chase. Both of you will be excellent hunters. And then there were also prophecies. And if Anishinaabe passes out of existence, all other humans will soon follow. And so our destiny is related to the destiny of Moingan, the wolf. And that's just a part of our teachings.
Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy of Stevens Point, designing and installing solar systems, highly efficient wood boiler systems, and providing deep energy retrofits to buildings. Northwind's project portfolio is available at northwindre.com.
I'm just a wild man. I'm just a real cool cat by Geiger. I'm just a wild man. I had breakfast with a tiger. You better smile, man.
We are talking about all things wild today with Eric Anderson and Scott Hingstrom, wildlife ecologists with UW Stevens Point, talking about Wisconsin's large animal wildlife population, 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. A federal judge in December threw out an Obama administration decision to remove gray wolves in the western Great Lakes region from the endangered species list, bringing an end to Wisconsin's wolf hunt. This affects Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin with a combined population at around 3,700. Eric Anderson, was this a wise thing? Do we need a wolf hunt in Wisconsin to control the population?
I don't think it was a good thing either for the wolf or for the state of Wisconsin to have created that kind of a situation where we no longer have control over the animal. Personally, we have populations that are going to exist in the wild of wolves. Their numbers are more than adequate to do that. However, the Endangered Species Act has been used in other than biological ways to try to control the hunt. There are some people that don't agree that it should happen. There are lots of people that think it should be done in a moderate way. The I think the most important thing is that sooner or later, the decision-making about this needs to fall to the state because those animals are no longer truly an endangered species biologically. They may still be a bone of contention politically and otherwise, but they don't belong back on the endangered species list.
Now, more than 1,500 Great Lakes wolves have been killed. There was a suit by the Humane Society of the United States that led to that ruling. Let's face it, this is a controversial thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, the tool it's being used for, the Endangered Species Act, has other better purposes that are really dealing with species that truly are endangered. The wolf is not an endangered species any longer in that area. However, there's a strong reaction that happens when you get some regressive legislation like the legislation that called for the hunt here in Wisconsin. It was pretty far extreme. It looked mm-hmm. like we were returning back to the 1930s and 40s in terms of how vindictive the legislation actually sounded like. We have to be careful about that if we want to maintain our power to deal with those populations.
Well, as we just heard at the beginning of the last underwriters break, we heard from Joe Rose, the tribal elder of the Bad River Tribe, who is talking about the special spiritual relationship Indians have with wolves. This is a spiritual creature. When you kill a wolf, according to Native Americans, you're violating their religion.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a mistake, I think, that was made in the initial legislation. Nobody really consulted with the tribes, where, in fact, they have the rights to much of the wildlife of the state, at least in the ceded territory, and they should have been consulted with this. So they were given permits that first year, and they did not harvest any wolves out of those permits.
Now, on the other side of the equation, we've got ranchers, farmers, bear hunters, and citizens who've been outspoken in demanding an aggressive hunt. And this federal ruling eliminates the tool that states were using to resolve these conflicts between humans and the wolf population.
Yes, exactly right. And Scott and I were just talking about the use of a new term. Instead of wildlife conflicts, talking about them as wildlife coexistence. We need to figure out how we can live with wolves in this state, not how we can eliminate them from the state. And to do that means you've got to approach it from everybody's perspective, and you've got to find some common ground that allows that species to continue to exist.
How dangerous are wolves? If you hear from people who say they're afraid to go hiking in the woods up north in areas where there are wolf packs, are attacks on humans rare? And if they occur at all, what can people do to protect themselves?
Yeah, extremely rare. There's actually only been two fatalities with wolves in North America, both of them under very extreme and unusual circumstances of animals that had become extremely habituated. Lots of times they may have been fed artificially. There are lots of circumstances that have led to that. For the most part, wolves do not like to interact with humans.
Eric Anderson and Scott Hingstrom of the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. We're talking about not just wolves, we're talking about white-tailed deer, we're talking about the reintroduction of elk, and we will be talking about cougars. If you have concerns or questions about any of those things, please give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Our phone lines are wide open right now. Let's move on to the reintroduction of elk into the state. We've got an elk herd right now in Clam Lake, but we're bringing elk in now from Kentucky. Why are we doing that, Scott Hingstrom?
Well, the whole idea was community-based. Clam Lake, they were able to reestablish their population of elk back in the mid-1990s, and now that population is up to about 160 animals. But about the same time, the community of Black River Falls and Jackson County area, the citizens there joined together along with the Ho-Chunk Nation, and they wanted to be able to establish their own population of elk. And so it's taken around 20 years to be able to get the approval and authorization to do all that. But as a matter of fact, there are 26 elk from Kentucky that are in Jackson County right now in a holding facility, and they're just waiting to get out.
Why are they in this holding facility?
Well, the whole idea is to monitor the animals for disease. They were held for a month in Kentucky after they were captured, and that was back in February. And to screen for diseases, brucellosis, bovine tuberculosis, and it happens to be a CWD-free state, and so hopefully we're administering that issue. They were brought up here.
In other words, we don't have to worry about chronic wasting disease in the elk population?
Well, we certainly hope not. They can catch it from deer, and so it's possible they'll contract it here in Wisconsin.
There was a farmer in central Wisconsin, Ray Stoner, who's an elk farmer from Pittsville in central Wisconsin, worried that these imported elk could carry disease to his deer herd.
Well, these elk are being screened for these diseases, and we're holding them another 3 months here in Wisconsin, and they'll be testing them for these diseases as well to determine that they're disease-free before they open the gates and allow the elk out, which is scheduled to be in mid-June.
Now, there's a common conception among many people that there's no live test for chronic wasting disease. But, Scott Hingstrom, that's not true.
Well, there is no live test for white-tailed deer and mule deer currently, but for elk, there is a live test. It's called a rectal biopsy, and you snip a little tissue from the rectum, and you can test for the presence of CWD.
But sounds like an expensive procedure, though.
It is, because...
Right? You have to sedate the elk and then go in there and get the sample and then
bring the
elk back again?
That's correct. Most elk won't stand still for you to take that little biopsy sample, so you do have to immobilize them and then do the testing of it. And I know that because they're assumed to be CWD free, I know they're mostly focused on bovine tuberculosis and brucellosis.
And Governor Walker says, quote, elk were once common here and we want that again. A healthy and thriving elk herd is a benefit to the state, increasing tourism in northern and central Wisconsin, where a limited herd is already a draw for elk viewing. So do you think that might happen to this second herd that we're trying to establish?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. The town of Clam Lake has benefited greatly by having elk in the area from the ecotourism and the money that people bring into that community. And Black River Falls anticipates the very same thing. There's an economic driver there that they anticipate taking advantage of. But in addition to that, as we were speaking about with wolves, the Ho-Chunk Nation is culturally very in tune and in touch with their brother, the elk. And so it's a very important driver for them to be involved in the reintroduction of elk. And I can tell you the Ho-Chunk Nation feels it's like almost a sigh of relief, this great benefit that they're going to be able to receive by having elk in that area.
We have a lot of partners who've been involved in this whole process. Talk about that.
That's right. It's been a tremendous partnership. And I was there at a celebration about a month ago in Black River Falls, and it was moderated by the Ho-Chunk Nation. They hosted it, but the Department of Natural Resources, the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point are involved, along with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the Jackson County Wildlife Fund, the Jackson County Parks Administration, and others. So it really is a true partnership, and it's a part that they want to make known that this is truly a community event.
What about elk hunting?
Yeah, well, it's anticipated that in time we'll be able to have an elk hunt in Wisconsin. The goals for elk in the Clam Lake region are in the 1,400 area, and right now we have 160. In the Black River Falls area, we currently have 26, and the goal is to have roughly 400 elk in that area. And once we reach those levels, we believe that the populations can sustain a harvest, and then I'm sure the state will be looking forward as far as having an elk hunt.
Well, Eric Anderson, this is Scott Hingstrom's bailiwick, but I want you to weigh in on it, too.
Yeah, certainly. We anticipated the elk population up at Clam Lake to have achieved a huntable level by now. But due to a variety of things, the habitat, certainly wolves and their eating of elk calves and us, yes, and humans and car collisions and other forms of mortality, they haven't achieved that 200 limit that we thought would be the trigger to allow for a hunt to occur. So I'm encouraged to see this second group of elk being brought in and very encouraged by the public support of it.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Hingstrom, I want to touch on something before we move on with the other large critters in Wisconsin. You are the director of something called the Wisconsin Institute for Wildlife. What is that?
Well, it's a brand new entity. You introduced me as the Douglas R. Stevens Endowed Chair of Wildlife, and that's a new program. It was $2 million that were contributed to the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point for the Stevens' son, Douglas, who passed away while working on a bear project. He was a graduate of Stevens Point, and so they contributed to that. I'm able to work on the interest, essentially, in doing wildlife programming statewide. And so what I'm hoping to do is connect students, wildlife professionals, and landowners for sustainable wildlife management. That's essentially what our institute will do.
Tell us about some of the stakeholders you've already brought together.
Oh, boy. Well, I've had fun traveling all over the state, meeting new people who work with various agencies and non-governmental organizations and landowners. And my first job was just networking, getting to know people in the state, and also seeing some of those old folks that I used to know. I did my master's at Stevens Point 30 years ago and worked on my PhD in Madison. And so there's still some of those old folks that are hanging around, still working in the agencies. And also many of them have retired, but they're still just personally invested in wildlife. And so I've been able to make connections with many people.
And again, some of those stakeholders, UW Extension, the Woodland Owners Association, the Department of Natural Resources, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Service, all helping out with this new entity, the Wisconsin Institute for Wildlife.
That's right. We have a steering committee currently, and all representatives of all of those agencies and organizations are serving on the steering committee, helping to guide this. And I view this as a program of shared leadership in which we are coming together to make decisions and move forward, identify priorities, gaps in knowledge, areas where we need more information on wildlife.
Wildlife ecologist Scott Hingstrom and Eric Anderson of UW Stevens Point's College of Natural Resources. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. When we come back, we will be talking about cougars, mountain lions in the state of Wisconsin.
Do you suppose we'll meet any wild animals?
We might. Animals that eat straw? Some, but mostly lions and tigers and bears.
Lions?
And tigers?
And bears. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs, including Steepenbrew, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, and The Bold Company. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
And as we return on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, the talk turns to cougars, mountain lions, and bobcats. We have one of the experts in that field with us today, Eric Anderson, along with Scott Hingstrom from the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. Eric Anderson, two new sightings in north-central Wisconsin this past summer, the two most recent discoveries from photographs from trail cameras on private land in Lincoln and Marinette counties. And that follows a string of such observations since 2008, the big cats officially disappeared from Wisconsin in 1910, but they are at least moving through if they aren't here permanently yet.
Yeah, absolutely. We're finally seeing a former resident of the state return naturally. No artificial movement of these guys. They're mostly coming from South Dakota populations, and males tend to disperse a lot further than females do, so these yearlings, they don't find a place left to inhabit there in the Black Hills because it's totally saturated with lions right now. They start wandering out from there, and some of them make their way through Wisconsin.
Do we have a breeding population of cougars in the state yet?
Well, what I'll say is I don't think so. There's not been any evidence of it. However, quickly tell you the story about the first mountain lion that we saw back in the state in 2008. It was seen down in the southern part of the state in January, And then no one saw it again until it was shot in the northern suburbs of Chicago 2.5 months later. So it existed on that landscape down there where there are lots of people and there is lots of agriculture, and nobody saw it. So it is possible we could have them in the state reproducing. We just don't know yet.
That was actually shot in the Roscoe neighborhood of Chicago. I grew up in Chicago, and I'm familiar with that area. And it's not a suburb. It's actually in the city of Chicago. If you can imagine a cougar jumping from yard to yard and climbing over fences until it was subdued, that was something else, you know?
Yeah, watching the footage on that, you can see these people that are fully armed in this real urban area, and a mountain lion running past them, behind them, as they're facing the other way. It was an unfortunate way for our first returning cougar to end its life. We didn't get to hold on to it very long.
Well, we had three confirmed sightings in 2014. We had one sighted in Lincoln County, east of Merrill, on July 30th. A Minnesota man, the owner of the property, reported the photo to the DNR, and it was verified. In the second case, the cougar in Marinette County was photographed with a trail cam on September 1st near Middle Inlet, which is north of Crivitz. And we had another confirmed sighting earlier in Bayfield County. But for those confirmed sightings, I mean, the DNR received 240 reports of cougars in 2013. How many of those do you think were real?
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of mistaken identity when it comes to mountain lions. Either people aren't familiar with them biologically, or many people just don't see them long enough to be able to pick up on identifying characteristics of it. So they are lots of reports that are actually of bears and of fisher and of dogs and of coyotes that have something called mange, where they lose their hair and look a little more cat-like. So, yeah, a lot of mistaken identity.
Is this a good thing, having cougars back in the state? I mean, what about the danger to hikers, children, and pets?
They ought to be a lot more worried about black bears. Those are the most deadly wild carnivore in North America. Mountain lions, yes, do on occasion kill people, but you're much more likely to be taken by a black bear.
And Eric Anderson, you're also doing research into bobcats in the state. Tell us about that.
Oh, we've had some great years with bobcats. Their populations exploded in northern Wisconsin about 10 years ago. And during that time period, they started dispersing out further south. So we've established some really good populations in the southern part of the state that we didn't have before. So we are figuring out ways to be able to count them, and for the first time, the DNR has opened the entire state to bobcat hunting and trapping.
And let's talk about that bear population, those dangerous bears. We have a rapidly expanding population. How many bears are too many bears in Wisconsin?
Well,
Scott Hingstrom?
You know, it's a matter of how much damage they cause. It's hard to put a number on the number that we can accept, but we can accept certain levels of damage. And it's a toss-up between crop damage as far as potential risk to human health and safety when you have a bear that's become acclimated and oftentimes habituated on humans. And an unfortunate phrase is a fed bear is a dead bear. They become used to us feeding them, and that's when they become dangerous.
Well, the conflicts with humans will be at their worst, like right about now when they're coming out of hibernation, and you've got all of these bird watchers feeding birds because the spring migration is occurring at the same time. We've got kind of an unfortunate confluence of two events.
Yeah, feeding of birds is a bit of a challenge as far as bears, because bears are coming out of winter. They need a lot of food at this point in time. They need energy to replace the energy that they've burned up through the winter while in dens. And sometimes they turn to bird feeders. And so we are still feeding birds at our home, but very soon we'll probably stop feeding birds. There's enough food out there very soon for the wild birds to be able to take it on themselves, and those bird feeders serve as attractants to wild bears.
Well, gentlemen, we're completely out of time. We face some challenging times for the Department of Natural Resources and for wildlife management in the state. Eric Anderson, a few very quick final thoughts.
Wow. This is an exciting state to deal with wildlife, and not only because of the abundance of wildlife that we have here, but the abundance of attitudes that people have towards it. It's a challenge, but it's one that I think we can meet by working together.
And Scott Hingstrom?
You know, a lot of my work goes towards human-wildlife coexistence, and I think there are ways we can resolve problems. We need to work together, make community decisions, and be aware. Be aware of all of our environmental issues, and work as a public to make solutions.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. We want to thank our guests, Dr. Eric Anderson, a professor of wildlife ecology at UW-Stevens Point, and Dr. Scott Hingstrom, the Douglas R. Stevens Chair in Wildlife and Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Wildlife. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to Nick Schultz and the staff at UW-Stevens Point for helping to make this program possible. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme, special music and audio segments today by Edvard Grieg, Los Lobos, Mose Allison, The Tokens, the soundtrack to The Wizard of Oz, and Sergei Prokofiev. Next week on Route 51, although some say it's past its time, it's still the national pastime as we talk baseball, the Wisconsin Woodchucks, the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, and the Milwaukee Brewers. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of this show, you can hear it in its entirety Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. The program can also be downloaded at wpr.org/route51. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.